Hi everyone. I'm going to give a 13 lecture course on cosmology. So it uses the reference I recommend is some notes by Daniel Bauman from I think a master's course at the University of Amsterdam. A year or two ago, the same author sort of elaborated these notes into a longer textbook. But the notes are still just easily available online. And for purposes of the material that I'll cover in the class, the notes are equivalent to the textbook, so they're just a little easier to find. And I'm going to do something like, I'm going to cover in the class three topics. First is like the expansion history of the universe and the geometry of space-time. That'll probably be three or four lectures, and that's most of the material in chapter one of these notes. Then I'll talk a bit about the thermal history of the universe. Things like where cosmic neutrinos and dark matter come from. And this is a little out of order. It'll be roughly chapter three. And then finally, in like the second half, I'll talk about the physics of inflation, which is chapters 2 and 6 of the notes. In between, I'm out of town for like about a week, or more like a week and a half. So there'll be like a 10-day gap. Thanks everyone for accommodating my travel schedule, which also made the timing of all the lectures a mess. Like they're at different times throughout the lecture. Okay. So in the first lecture, or in the first three lectures or so, I'm going to talk about the expansion history and geometry of the universe, which is mostly talking about this object, the FLRW metric, which describes the geometry of our universe on large scales. So I'm just going to write it down first as an ansatz. And then I'll explain where it comes from in the course of elaborating its properties. An equivalent notation for the FRW metric is this. The metric is parameterized by a free function of time, a of t, which is called the scale factor. And represents the expansion the expansion of the universe, or its expansion history over time. I'll make that a bit more precise in a moment. So if you just say FLRW metric, then you're leaving that function a of t unspecified. It may help to sort of orient yourself to the discussion. It may help to have a picture in your mind for what a of t looks like in our universe. I'll write this down for now with no derivation, and then I'll slowly derive it. I'll probably finish the derivation sometime in tomorrow's lecture. So in our universe, A of t starts out at 0. That's the Big Bang, when the scale factor of the universe is 0 and every point is on top of every other point. There's a initial period where the scale factor grows proportional to t to the 1/2. And that's the period when the universe is radiation dominated, but rad for radiation. And it lasts for around 10 to the 5 years. And radiation is cosmologist speak for any species of relativistic particles. So this just means that the universe was dominated by relativistic particles, such as photons or neutrinos, which were also relativistic at this time. Then There's a long period where this curve steepens a bit. I'm not sure I can do a good job of drawing this, but this feature is not very dramatic if you actually plot it, but the growth rate steepens slightly from t to the 1/2 to t to the 2/3. This is the period of matter domination. Let's say this is time in years. And this lasts for about 10 to the 10 years. Matter is, cosmologists speak for non-relativistic particles, such as dark matter and most of the standard model. And then finally, very recently, the universe is starting to switch over to qualitatively different exponentially expanding phase, where the stress energy of the universe is dominated by the cosmological constant. It's famously measured to be non-zero. And we live here in the plot when the universe has just recently started to switch over to an exponential phase around 13.8 billion years after the Big Bang. And the final comment is that the scale factor is chosen to be 1 today by convention. Formally, you can see that you can always make the scale factor 1 today by rescaling the x-coordinates in the metric. Okay. If you've seen, I did the wrong thing. I should have brought this down. If you've seen cosmology before, then you may know that I've written the FLRW metric down in slightly less than maximal generality. This is really what's called the flat FLRW metric, where the metric on the spatial hyperservices is assumed to be Euclidean. And there's also a curved FLRW metric where those dimensions are allowed to curve onto a sphere or into a hyperboloid. I'm going to come back to and talk about that later. So probably in lecture 3. So for the first two lectures, I'm assuming spatial flatness. Okay. So now I want to just start systematically developing the physics of this metric. The first thing that you'll notice is that it's spatially homogeneous. There's no x dependence anywhere in the metric. And so there are no spatial perturbations. Of course, that's not perfectly true. Objects like galaxies are spatial inhomogeneities. And so this is a coarse-grained description that applies on sufficiently large scales. I think it's really useful to think about the FRW metric in terms of its symmetries. So I want to write down the symmetries of this metric. So I think there are a few symmetries that are fairly self-evident. So one is translation symmetry, or that is to say there's no preferred point in spacetime. The other is rotation symmetry, since the metric is just the spatial metric is proportional to delta ij. You can rotate it freely and it stays the same. Another way of saying it is that there's no preferred direction in an FLRW spacetime. The non-symmetries are maybe more interesting. So there are, in general, no boost-like symmetries of this metric. Except in special cases, like if A of t is 1 for all values of t, then the metric is Minkowski. This is not a statement that I'm going to prove. You could sort of convince yourself of that empirically by trying, and you'll always find that you get some problem, like the appearance of space-time terms in the metric. The proof is a little long, unfortunately, so I felt like it was too much of a tangent for the class. I can't resist saying that in addition to Minkowski, There are a few other special cases, like an exponentially increasing A of t, that do have boost-like symmetries. Those are the so that's the so-called De Sitter metric. For a general function A of t, there are no boost-like symmetries. That's a theorem that you can prove. There's also no the other symmetry, which is present for Minkowski but not FLRW, is a time translation symmetry. Just because there's a function A of t in the metric, if I time translate, then I get a different expansion history where things have been moved over. So let me not clutter up the plot with that. So these are really interesting statements because the absence of a boost symmetry means physically that the universe has a rest frame, which is something that's not true in special relativity or Minkowski. So the universe has a preferred rest frame. It's meaningful in this metric to say whether you're moving or not. The universe also has a preferred clock. Just for fun, I think it's fun to point out that there are experiments you can do to determine whether you're to determine the value of the clock in the universe or whether you're at rest in the universe. Imagine this scenario. You go to sleep. And you wake up at a random place in space and time, and you want to know, am I moving relative to the rest frame of the universe? How many billion years has it been since the Big Bang? What's the value of the clock? You can answer these questions if you do a C if you build a CMB experiment and take a little data. Just for fun, this is a bit of a tangent. I came prepared to tell you a little bit about the CMB. I decided not to make slides just to show two pictures, so I'm just gonna show them on the laptop. Everyone has probably seen this picture. This is what's usually shown when a picture of the CMB is presented. This is the primordial part of the CMB. This interesting random-looking pattern of hot and cold spots. The primordial part of the CMB that comes from times near the Big Bang, with an amplitude of around 100 microkelvin. That's usually shown after subtracting off some larger signals, which are not so interesting. On top of that, there's a larger signal, the CMB dipole, which is, just a pure dipole, as shown in the figure, which is around 3 millikelvin. Finally, these signals are small perturbations on top of a homogeneous distribution, the CMB monopole. To zeroth order, the CMB has the same temperature in every direction, a temperature of around 2.7 Kelvin. I'm going to talk for a bit just about the monopole and the dipole. The interesting thing about the monopole is that it slowly changes with time. I'll show this later in the lecture, I think. If I wait a billion years, then the value of the CMB temperature will decrease by about 7%. That means there's a one-to-one correspondence between time, or years since the Big Bang, and the temperature of the CMB. If you build this CMB experiment and measure this monopole, then you can read the value of your clock or the number of years it's been since the Big Bang. If the CMB monopole is like a cosmic clock, then the CMB dipole is like a cosmic speedometer. A formal way to say it is that the CMB dipole is a vector-like quantity. It has a direction and a magnitude. It does indeed transform as a vector under Lorentz boosts, in a boosted frame, you get a different value. In fact, you can see our CMB dipole change by about 10% throughout the year as the Earth goes around the Sun and the velocity of the CMB experiment changes. There's a unique frame in which the CMB dipole is zero, sometimes referred to as the CMB rest frame. And that's the preferred rest frame of the FRW metric. So if you wake up at a random place in the universe and you want to know whether you're at rest or moving, then you just need to build a CMB experiment with enough sensitivity to measure the dipole. Well, I think I have a bad habit of writing on the board where it's obscured by the podium. So if I do that, just feel free to shout. Just to introduce you to some definitions, the first few lectures in a cosmology class are very definition heavy. So a co-moving observer just means an observer who's at rest in the preferred rest frame of the universe. In the coordinate system in which I've written the FLRW metric, the co-moving observers are the ones whose spatial coordinates xi are constant. Here's a picture of space-time with time on the y-axis and x on the and space on the x-axis, and here are two co-moving observers. Their world lines are just constant in x. What the function a of t means is the following. Imagine that two co-moving observers measure the distance between them at different times. So these could be observers in two different galaxies, say, which are approximately co-moving. So let me denote that distance delta x physical, just to emphasize that it's the physical distance that you would measure with a physical ruler. Then that distance is time dependent for two co-moving observers. It's the scale factor a of t multiplied by the coordinate distance between the two observers, which is constant if they're both co-moving. That follows directly from the metric, because to get the distance between two events, you just integrate ds, the square root of the metric ds squared. And so ds squared has one factor of a of t in it. And so ds squared has two factors of a of t, ds has one factor of a of t. And so this is the precise sense in which the universe is expanding in an FLRW cosmology. The distance between two galaxies, or more generally co-moving observers, is growing with time. So it's like as if space is stretching between the galaxies. A lot of getting used to the FLRW metric is just writing equations like this and getting some intuition for where to stick factors of a of t. For example, one interesting thing we can do in the space-time diagram is to draw some light cones. So I claim that draw them over here. So I claim that in this metric, light cones are curved. Let's say that this point represents us today at 13.8 gig years. That light cones are curved, or more precisely, the slope dx over dt is 1 over a of t. Just for fun, let me put some numbers on this plot. So this is 13.8 gigayears. If this is 0, then down here this is at 46 gigalight years. It's the size of the co-moving size of the observable universe. And then up here, this This future light cone actually converges to a finite width in the far future. That's around 16 billion light years. One funny property of our universe is that there are galaxies out here on our light cone that we can see today with telescopes. But even if we developed light speed travel tomorrow, we couldn't actually like set out in a rocket and reach those galaxies. They're outside of our future causal light cone. This has to do with the exponentially growing AFT that I mentioned before. It's like steepening out these curves exponentially at late times. So why is this? Why is the slope of a light cone 1 over a? So one way to derive that is to imagine the light cone as observed from a local observer who measures the speed of light, always measures the speed of light to be 1, and the physical speed of light that a local observer measures is, you know, physical time per physical distance per time, and then physical distance is a of t times coordinate distance dx dt. By the way, I should maybe pause to explain one little notational point. It's almost always more convenient to do calculations in co-moving coordinates and convert to physical units at the end by sticking in factors of a. And that's reflected in my notation. If I write like x with no subscript, it always means co-moving. And I'll put the subscript in when I on the occasions where I want to use physical distances, which or equivalently, the slope of the light cone is 1 over a. Another more formal GR way of deriving the same thing is to note that for a null geodesic, or the trajectory of a photon, the differential spacetime interval ds is always equal to 0. We write that as 0 equals ds squared. And then in the FRW metric, ds squared has this form, which also rearranges to dx over dt being 1 over a. Okay. So I think that gives the basic picture of the FLRW metric. Now I want to start computing things more precisely, like figuring out, you know, the exact equations of motion that are satisfied by geodesics, working on curvature, that sort of thing. And so I'm going to start by computing some Christoffel symbols and analyzing geodesics. I want to maybe pause for 10 minutes. I'll get back to the FLRW metric. But I want to maybe pause for 10 minutes to just kind of do a general review of these concepts from GR. I'd like to review the GR in like a little bit more generality than I use it in the class, just because part of the, I think what you get out of a cosmology class is just practice doing GR calculations. And also GR is just such a beautiful theory. It's like a joy to review it. Let me remind you first that in GR there's a covariant derivative. If you want to differentiate a tensor and get another tensor, then you want the covariant derivative, which looks like this. There's you start with the ordinary partial derivative. And then there are some Christoffel symbol terms. So there's a, for each upper index, you have a Christoffel symbol term where you bring the upper index into the Christoffel symbol, and then subtract. There's only one way to rearrange the indices so that you get a contraction that makes sense So you just need to remember the sign here. It's a plus sign for an upper index and a minus sign for a lower index. Where the Christoffel symbol is defined this way. I tend to think of the first equation as being like the definition of the Christoffel symbol. It's just something that arises if you want to take covariant derivatives. And this, the second as the equation that you use to calculate it in a given metric. And then a geodesic is a curve x mu of lambda, where the so-called affine parameter lambda can be proper time for a timeline geodesic, time-like geodesic, and for a null for a light-like geodesic tells you how photon frequencies evolve, such that the geodesic equation is satisfied. Satisfying the geodesic equation. Which I'll write this way. Where v mu is the covariant for velocity of the geodesic. So this form of the geodesic equation applies to either a time-like geodesic or a light-like geodesic, but the meaning of the affine parameter is different in the two cases. So for a time-like geodesic, so I find it most intuitive to take the affine parameter to be the proper time tau experienced by. So time-like geodesics just represent world lines of freely falling observers or massive particles. And the proper time is just the time carried on a watch that is carried by the freely falling observer, which means that the four momentum q mu, if I think of the observer as a massive particle, is related to the four velocity of the geodesic by a factor of the rest mass. By the way, I always use q for momenta or for momenta, because in a few lectures I'll start using p for pressure. And then for a light-like geodesic, representing the world line of like a freely falling photon, I like to choose the affine parameter lambda so that the four momentum of the geodesic, or the energy and momentum of the photon, are just the same thing as the covariant four velocity. The affine parameter for a geodesic is unique up to rescaling, and so you can always rescale it so that, you know, this is true. Or, But for a time like geodesic, I find it more intuitive to put in a factor of the rest mass so that lambda is the proper time. Okay. So that's the end of my like mini review of covariant derivatives, Christoffel symbols, geodesics. These are some equations that apply in any spacetime. And now I'm going to start specializing to FLRW with the goal of writing down and solving the geodesic equation so that we know what happens to freely falling observers in the spacetime. So the first thing to do is to calculate Christoffel symbols. And so if you've calculated a Christoffel symbol recently, this will be a really straightforward exercise. But since it may have been a while, let me write it down for in one example. So I'll calculate this Christoffel symbol with one space index, one time index, and two spatial indices arranged like this. Generally speaking, these sorts of calculations in cosmology always break down into multiple cases depending on which indices are spatial or time. So let me organize the calculation this way from so in this line, I'll just write out the definition of the Christoffel sum. Greek indices like lambda always run from 0 to 3, and spatial indices like ijk always run from 1 to 3. And then in this line, I'll start. So in particular, you know, the lambda here could be either a space index or a time index. But then, so in the next line, I'm just going to notice which terms are 0 in the FLRW metric. The metric g j lambda, because j is spatial, lambda must also be spatial for it to be non-zero, so I'll put a k there. And then going through these terms one by one, so I do get, and replacing lambda by k, I do get something non-zero here, but the remaining terms are all zero. So this guy is zero, well, either because the index lambda must be spatial, or because, if it were g 0, 0, then the derivative would be 0, since that component of the metric is equal to minus 1. And then this term is also 0 because g 0 I is equal to 0. Okay, and then in the next step, I'll substitute in plus a squared delta jk here. Sorry, a to the minus 2 delta jk. And then here I have the time derivative of a squared delta ik. And so then end up with this in the end. If I take delta jk and contract it with delta ik, it's easy to see that you get delta ji. And the terms with a's in them just give a dot over a. Let me just pause here to sneak in one more definition, which is h of t is called the Hubble rate, and it's just defined to be a dot over a. It's like the Hubble rate or Hubble expansion rate. And it has units of inverse time, And it's just the fractional expansion rate of the universe per unit time. Today it's a number of order 10 to the minus 10 years. And that means that every year the universe is expanding by one part in 10 to the 10. In hindsight, we could have anticipated that this Christoffel symbol would come out equal to delta, proportional to delta ij, just because of rotation symmetry. The underlying metric is rotationally symmetric. So there's a bunch of other cases to work out next that I'll leave as exercises. In many of them, in many cases, the Christoffel symbol, it has to be zero by symmetry. So the complete Christoffel symbols are as follows. Let me write out the one that I already calculated. So this is H delta ij. And then the other non-zero one is the Christoffel symbol with also a Christoffel symbol with two spatial indices in one time. This is a squared h delta ij. This one you'll calculate in tutorial one by a very similar calculation. And then the remaining Christoffel symbols are all zero, just to write those all out. So there's this guy. There's two possibilities with two spatial indices, and then there's the case with three spatial indices. Just as an aside, these three Christoffel symbols have to vanish by symmetry, and so you could avoid calculating them. The ones with a single spatial index can't be non-zero because then there would be a preferred direction. The one with three spatial indices, or I guess more generally an odd number of spatial indices, has to vanish by reflection symmetry. In the case of the Christoffel symbol with all zeros, there's no symmetry argument that I think that it has to be zero. But if you calculate it, you'll see quite quickly that it ends up vanishing. So next I want to integrate the geodesic equation, I actually want to comment first on like a little subtlety that will come up in the calculation. I said before that getting used to this metric is just largely a matter of figuring out where to stick all the powers of A. So in particular, you might notice when I talk about geodesics, I'm going to be talking about four momenta. And so you might notice that for a geodesic with four momentum q mu, if I write q, the four momentum with a lowered spatial index, it's related to the four momentum with an upper spatial index by a factor of a squared. You might notice that there's sort of two notions of three momentum, depending on whether you decide to write it with an upper index or a lower index, that are related by powers of a. So that's fine. But then you might ask, like, which one of these, if either, is the real physical four momentum? Write that like this. Which is a well-defined concept. I could ask if q mu is the four momentum of a geodesic, say a massive particle. I stick a physical particle detector along the world line, and it measures the physical momentum of the particle and energy with like physical clocks and rulers. What value is read out by the detector? So it turns out to be sort of halfway in between. I'll derive this in a minute. You can write the physical momentum either as A of t times q upper I, or 1 over A q lower I. For sort of a hand-wavy derivation of that, just to convince yourself that this is the right answer, this is the derivation that's in all the cosmology textbooks. I find there's something a little unsatisfying about it, but I'll put it on the board anyway. I do agree that it's a convincing short calculation that gives the right answer. So if Q mu is the four momentum of a massive particle with some rest mass mu naught, then I can write this with a minus sign. The covariance square of the four momentum has to be, with my metric sign convention, minus the square of the rest mass. Okay. And then writing that out for the FRW metric, I get minus Q naught squared minus, let's say, A of T squared times Q upper I squared. Sorry, this should be a plus. And so this only makes sense if, let's see, I prefer to write this with the upper index, Q0 squared. And so this only makes sense. This can only come out equal to the squared rest mass if Q0 is the physically measured energy. Remember, we also know that the physical energy and momenta read out by a real particle detector always have to satisfy this constraint. And so we can infer that things are only consistent if Q0 is the physical energy, and then Q upper I has to be 1 over A times Q physical. Maybe a better way of writing it is Q physical is A times Q upper I. That's one way of deriving it. Okay. I wanted to do that first because it'll tell us like how to interpret the quantities that come up in the geodesic equation. Okay, so now let's write the geodesic equation. That's just a matter of taking the general form of the geodesic equation on the top blackboard and plugging in the forms of the Christoffel symbols on the bottom blackboard. And so an FLRW geodesic is a curve XU of lambda whose four velocity satisfies these equations. I'm going to skip this step because okay. Where V mu is the covariant force. Okay. And so these equations turn out to these are equations of motion that I can solve to find the trajectory of a geodesic. And it turns out there's a little trick for solving them. It looks like sort of two equations and two unknowns, or four equations and four unknowns if you count the vector index. But there's a nice way of eliminating one of them, which is to take the second equation and notice that V. So H, remember, is 1 over A times dA dt. And then V0 is dt d lambda. And so if you plug those in, then you can write it as a differential equation with let me actually write that as two steps like this. Where's this? Let's say. Oops. Minus 2 times. So then I can write the equation as if I rearrange this a bit, I can write it as a differential equation with dvi dA on the left hand side, minus 2 over A vi on the right hand side. As a differential equation in A, you can read off the solution v upper I is a. This is easy to solve and just says that v upper I is proportional to a to the minus 2. Or equivalently, since or equivalently, the physical momentum of the geodesic is proportional to 1 over a. I think that's a more physical way of thinking about this. Since that's true because I'll fill in a few steps there. We found that Q physical was related to Q upper I by 1 power of A. And then for both types of geodesics, Q upper I is proportional to V upper I. The proportionality of constant, they're equal in the massless case, and there's a power of M naught in the massive case with my conventions. And then this goes like A times A to the minus 2. And so Q physical is proportional to 1 over A of T. For both time-like and light-like geodesics, the physical spatial momentum, there's a simple rule that says that it just decays as 1 over A as the universe expands. So the interpretation, I guess, is a little different in the two cases. For a photon, what it means, so the physical momentum is the same thing as the energy or the frequency of the photon. This is the famous redshifting effect, where if you emit a photon and then the universe expands, then the energy of that photon goes down by 1 over a. Earlier in the lecture, we derived what the trajectory of a photon or a light ray looks like in a space-time diagram. This equation, which comes out of integrating the geodesic equation, has extra information. It tells you about the famous redshifting effect, that the frequency of the photon is decreasing with time. For a massive particle, the momentum always redshifts as 1 over a, but now the momentum is a little more complicated. It's, this quantity. If the particle is initially relativistic, then its velocity stays close to 1, but its momentum is redshifting at 1 over a. And then as soon as it becomes non-relativistic, then the momentum is just mv, and the velocity decays as 1 over a. So this effect is called Hubble drag for a massive particle. What it means is that the expansion of the universe will eventually set the velocity of a particle to 0. That's why observers today are approximately co-moving. We live in galaxies that are approximately at rest in the FLRW rest frame, because Hubble drag is always acting to align everything onto the rest frame of the universe. I won't really get a chance to talk much about the theory of structure formation in cosmology, but You can view it sort of as a competition between gravitational instability, which is trying to sort of stir things up in source velocities, and Hubble drag, which is always trying to set velocities to zero. And you end up with today, it turns out, objects like galaxies in cosmology generally end up with have velocities of order 10 to the minus 3, something small but non-zero, as a result of the competition between these effects. I now have in my notes stop here so the students can get lunch, so let's do that. Let me first ask, are there any questions today? I guess we covered a lot of ground. We wrote down the metric of the universe, worked out some Christoffel symbols, and then figured out how geodesics evolved and introduced a lot of notation. Any questions on any of these blackboards before we go to lunch?
Could you maybe repeat the point about the universe having a preferred rest frame?
I do view it as sort of a symmetry property of the metric. You might think that there's a way to, here's one way of saying it, there's no way to make the universe expand in GR without introducing some sort of preferred rest frame where that expansion is happening. I don't think that's like totally obvious in advance. By the way, one really important comment about the FLRW metric that I forgot to say, that I meant to say, is that, so I said that the metric has this particular set of symmetries, and that statement actually has a converse. If you assume these symmetries properly defined, just translation and rotation symmetry, then it follows that the universe must be of FLRW form, with the small loophole that it is allowed to have spatial curvature, and I didn't actually tell you how spatial curvature worked yet. This wasn't exactly the question you asked, but I just realized I should say that the form of the FLRW metric, it's not really an ansatz. It's something that's forced by symmetry, by the statements that the universe doesn't have preferred locations or preferred directions, which seems to be true observationally, together with the statement that GR is the correct theory of gravity. The statement about there being a preferred rest frame or not having boosts. So that really depends on the scale factor evolving. If the scale factor were equal to 1, we lived in Minkowski space, then there would be boosts. There would be no preferred direction. But it's just sort of a non-obvious feature of GR that as soon as you put in the expansion, as soon as you make A of T have some interesting evolution, then you lose the boost symmetry and you're forced to have a preferred rest frame.
And we have constant, so you mentioned spatial curvatures, and we assume, homogeneity assumption guarantees that we can only have constant curvature of the universe, right? K is equal to 0, 1, and minus 1. So that comes from homogeneity assumption.
Yeah, that's correct. So I'm sort of motivating the FLRW metric as a statement about symmetry.
Yeah.
Just as symmetric to say that the universe is, I'm just talking about the spatial slices of the universe, to say that they're spatially flat, Euclidean, or curved onto a sphere with some positive curvature. For purposes of teaching the class, I could have just made the assumption that the universe was flat and just written down the flat FLRW metric. Since that is what we see in observations, curvature is consistent with zero with very small error bars nowadays. Since I was motivating the FLRW metric from symmetry considerations, you should say that this possibility is just as consistent with those symmetry statements as this possibility. I apologize for sort of half talking about curvature. I've told you that it exists and drawn a picture of it, but I haven't actually written down what the FLRW metric looks like in the presence of spatial curvature. I'll do that in a few lectures. It's just kind of algebraically messy, so I wanted to put in that algebraic baggage at the end. Another little comment that I'll make is that in the next lecture, we'll compute the Riemann curvature and Ricci curvature. And those are non-zero, even for the flat FL or RW metric. There's just distinguishing between space-time curvature, which has Greek indices that run from 0 to 3, and the spatial curvature of these space-like hypersurfaces if you throw away the time coordinate. When I say curved or flat FL or RW, I'm just talking about the spatial curvature. But the space-time curvature is non-zero in all cases.
And could you comment again the names in CMB, monopole, dipole, and primordial? Is it just like a nomenclature, or just it really refers to something like monopole radiation, dipole radiation, and so on?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I didn't really explain that. So the they are... So the CMB is a field, a scalar field, but it's a scalar field defined on a sphere. So it's a function, say, of a unit 3 vector theta hat. And so the analog of the Fourier transform for a field defined on a sphere is the spherical harmonic expansion. We expand it this way. And so in that expansion, the monopole is, the 0, 0 term. Y0, 0 is just constant. Happens to be 1 over square root 4 pi, but it's just a constant. So the monopole is just a fancy way of saying the sky average CMB temperature. And then the dipole terms are the m equals 1 terms. So the monopole is huge. It's 3 Kelvin. And then the dipole terms are still quite a bit larger than everything else. They're around 3 Kelvin. And they're interpreted as just our motion relative to the CMB rest frame. And then the higher terms are small. And they really come from the early universe. And they're kind of like a snapshot of the universe shortly after the Big Bang. Thanks for the questions. Those questions are really great. Please feel free to heckle with questions during the lecture, because sometimes I say things like monopole and dipole. It's easy when you've been doing it for a while to just sort of throw out terminology and not realize you're properly defining things.